Hello, this is the Trimmed Down podcast version of Tracks of My Life with me, Toby Davey. To catch all my guests' music tracks in full, do listen in to the hour-long version on RNIB Connect Radio every Tuesday at 7 p.m, repeated Thursdays at 1 p.m. and Sundays at 8 p.m. Hello, I'm Toby Davey and you're listening to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio. In Tracks of My Life, we invite a guest to select a few tracks that mean something to them and mark moments in their life. From maybe that first track they ever heard, right through to one track that they would like to pass on that might give hope for the future. My guest this week is presenter of Connect Radio Sunset Melodies and easy listening music fan, Gary Moritz. Hello, Gary, and welcome to Tracks of My Life here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hi there, Toby.
Gary, of course, many listeners will know your voice from Sunset Melodies here on Connect Radio and a show that you've presented for a number of years. How did you find it having to just select seven tracks then?
Well, because I do present Sunset Melodies, I'm choosing tracks all the time. So I actually found the track selection not too difficult. It was more what chapters in my life should I include, or perhaps more importantly, which one should I leave out. And it was just simply a case of matching a track with those chapters rather than sort of selecting favorite songs and things like that. So it was more about, oh yeah, that track takes me back to that time.
Your first track, Gary, is Westminster Waltz by the Robert Farnham Orchestra, which takes you back, I think, to preschool days. What was your early life like growing up then?
Yeah, well, I wanted to say, as we start this journey, that I realise how much music has played a part in my life and how it's all led up to the presentation of Sunset Melodies. You know, when I link it all together, I think, my goodness, I don't think I could have done this show without this journey of taking an interest in this kind of music, because so much of it was before my time. And I realised, wow, you know, all these years of taking an interest in music has built towards doing this show. And I think it all starts when I was actually preschool age, you know. I can remember tracks from that time, so I'm thinking of songs like Petula Clark's Downtown, or The Beatles' Norwegian Wood, Loving Spoonful, Daydream, Downtown by Roger Whittaker. Herb Albert was always on the radio. I always remember these sounds. And I think when I heard them, perhaps when I got a little bit older, they straight away took me back to my very young days. And yeah, I lived in a suburban town northwest of London, and I had a pretty ordinary suburban life. My memories always seem to link up with my grandparents, and particularly my grandparents on my mother's side. And they used to look after me. I used to go over to their maisonette in Wembley, North Wembley, and spend weekends there after school, be dropped off on a Friday afternoon. And I got these lovely memories of their maisonette for a start, because it was so old-fashioned compared to my other grandparents. It was very, I suppose it couldn't have been much different to how it was even in the war years, really, because it would have only been sort of 25 years later, I suppose. My grandmother always used to get me to help her cook in the kitchen, and the one thing I always remember was how she got me to help her make chips using a chip maker, putting a potato in and pushing it through this grid to make these chips. I thought, oh, great, we're having chips tonight, you know. But the thing that always struck me when I look back on her life, my grandmother's life, in a radio show, I thought it'd be something quite different to actually pay tribute to somebody who's not famous, but just a very, very ordinary lady, my grandmother. I thought, yeah, why not do a radio show just based on someone like that? And one of the things she used to do was we would have our dinner, and then my granddad would go and sit in his chair in the living room where the TV was, and I'd go and join him. And then my grandmother would come in a little bit later with a tray of tea and some buttered buns or something like that, and we'll settle down to watch TV. But the thing she used to do was she used to turn the light off. And so it would be pitch black, apart from the light from the TV and the light from the open fire that they used to have. And I used to love looking into this fire and watching things burn, you know, throw pieces of paper onto this fire and stuff. I sort of later on thought, why did she always used to turn the lights off? Because she used to do that when she came and babysat for us. And it must have been something to do with the Blitz or something, you know, like, turn that light off. And so she used to turn the lights off. But it created this kind of cosy ambience in the room. And I think it must have left me with this feeling over the years that's contributed towards that sort of intimate sense I tried to give in the show with the music. I tend to play easygoing music rather than sort of noisy, upbeat music. Every time I listen to light music, and particularly this track, it just takes me right back to those very early days of my life.
The Robert Farnon Orchestra there and Westminster Waltz. For your next track, Guy, we come to teenage years for you and your growing love of music and many hours spent in a local record shop too. And I think your first love of music was with Elvis, and I wondered what sort of impact did Elvis's music have on you when you first heard his music?
I discovered Elvis when I was age 11. My parents used to have an album called Smash Hits Presley Style. And I thought, well, what's this album? And it didn't have a picture of Elvis. Watching Top of the Pops, I was used to seeing T-Rex, Slade, Sweet, Mud, you know, people like that. The Osmonds, that sort of era. But I always knew that there was somebody out there who was this superstar, who had everything, looks, he was exciting. He was tall, he was handsome, whatever it was. I just knew there was somebody out there like that, and I didn't know who it was. And I used to read the back of his album cover, and I thought, well, the name Elvis Presley sort of conjures up that kind of image. And songs like Blue Suede Shoes and Hound Dog certainly fit in. It must be this person, but I wonder what he looks like. And then one day, I saw an album of Elvis, 40 Greatest Hits, I think it was, and I thought, ah, that must be the guy. Big smile was beaming back at you. And so I asked for this LP for Christmas, and it took off from there, and I just became a fanatic. I met a friend at school who found out who was an Elvis fan, and we connected straight away just through liking Elvis. And we became very, competitive, if you like, in trying to build up an Elvis collection. We both joined a fan club. We went to Elvis events. This is around the time he died. I wouldn't touch or even consider buying a record that wasn't Elvis for about 5 years until I was about 16. And then one day I thought, yeah, this is ridiculous. I got to start listening to other music. I always remember the first two albums I bought were the Best of the Eagles and Roll Gold, the Rolling Stones compilation. And so I sort of started to branch out with what I spent my money on. And during this time, I became curious about Frank Sinatra. So I knew the name. I was obviously aware of him. And I always remember asking my mum, I was about 15. I said, so how good or how popular was Frank Sinatra? And she goes, oh God, yeah, you know, very popular. I thought, yeah, but he's not rock and roll. He's not rock. So I can't imagine myself ever taken to Sinatra, you know. And then I heard a song of his on the radio one day. Again, I was about 15. I'd come home from school, I always remember it. And it was him singing Let Me Try Again. And I listened to it, and I thought, I quite like that. I think I could probably take to Frank Sinatra. And I acquired one of his LPs for Christmas. And then I remember having a hits compilation. And that was it for a little while. And then, as I say, we used to go down to this fantastic record shop in South Harrow called Sell 'n Buy. and it was all second-hand records, mostly. And one day, I saw his Frank Sinatra albums all displayed from the 50s, mainly from the 50s, his Capitol albums. They looked like wonderful album covers, and I became very curious about these albums. And there were some Nat King Cole ones, and Dean Martin and so on, and they looked lovely and nostalgic. And for some reason, I was drawn to them, and I thought, I'm going to buy one or two of these. And I did recognise the Song for Swingin' Lovers album cover, because my mother had an EP of Frank Sinatra from that album. And again, I probably used to look at it at home and thinking, oh, I wonder what this is like, but never ever played it, you know. And so I bought that album, and I came out, and I was really struck by how cool this album was. It had a sound, a Nelson Riddle arrangements that I thought, yeah, I really like this. And I started to build up my Sinatra collection and delving into that kind of music, the sort of pre-rock and roll type music that's more jazz based. Even though it seemed to be a little bit beyond my years, I started to take to it. And of the albums that of all the albums, I mean, they're all fantastic albums, but the one that stood out, it seemed, was one called In the Wee Small Hours. And it's the intimacy, this sort of late night feeling you get from this album, which is actually one of, if not the first concept album that was ever released. It's to give off this idea of this sad, lonely guy sitting in his room. It starts off with the first track, In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning. It's like he's lying in bed thinking about the girl and not able to think about counting sheep, in so many words. And it's like as if he's, throughout the whole album, he's lying in bed thinking about all these thoughts, you know, melancholic thoughts. And I thought, I could really relate to that. So it's a track off that album that I've chosen that takes me back to those great days of going to that record shop and expanding my taste in music to the likes of Frank Sinatra and Ella Fitzgerald, Nat King Cole. I bought many albums of that ilk. My friend used to laugh at me. He said, what are you buying all that for, you know? But of course, it paved the way many years later for me to do a show like Sunset Melodies.
Fools rushing, so here I am, very glad to be unhappy.
Glad to Be Unhappy There by Frank Sinatra, and a track that I think is sort of you, Gary. Now we come to a track, Gary, that marks the time when you were diagnosed with, I think, retinitis pigmentosa and maybe Usher's disease as well. And it also started your love of old movies too. Was the RP and the Ushers, was that something that had always been sort of possibly around, or was it something that happened quite suddenly for you? And sort of how did you feel at that time?
Yeah, it was something that came out of the blue, really. I was actually told I had a hearing problem when I was at school, and so I was made to sit at the front of a class, and I hated that. So we were aware of my hearing problem, and then, as I say, when I was just coming into the age of 16, I noticed I wasn't seeing properly at night. And I mentioned it to my mother, and she said, well, what do you mean? I said, well, I just can't see anything in the dark. And so we went into my bedroom. She shut all the lights out and the door and everything else and said, well, how many fingers do I have up? And I said, well, I can't even see you. And so she panicked, and next thing I know that the doctors who referred me to the hospital, and I had a number of doctors look at me, and they were all overlooked by this professor. And next thing I know, the professor called my mother in, and they were in there for about 45 minutes. I thought, what on earth is going on? Eventually, I got called in, and I was told I had this condition called retinitis pigmentosa, and that I would probably go blind by the age of 40. And I thought, oh my goodness. And I realised why my mum looked so grey, so forlorn, and I thought she must have been told this and totally broke down. I remember the journey home on the train, and my mother couldn't speak. I just kept staring out the window thinking, what am I going to do? But regardless of that, the next couple of years, I still took up the idea of driving for some reason. Because it was obviously at those days, at that stage, it was just my night vision that was troublesome. Eventually, my day vision would be affected. I sort of sat and thought about it and thought, there's no point in me carrying on with this. You know, it's a lot of money down the drain. I'm not going to be able to drive. So I decided to put my money into travelling. I used to sort of dream about the idea, and this is where Elvis comes in again, of going to Hawaii, thinking that I would never ever be able to go there, being so expensive and everything. And then one day, I was about 19 at this time, and 18 actually, when I first came across this brochure. So I put the idea to a colleague who worked in the jewellers opposite. I was working in a jewellers at the time. He was only 17 at the time, and he actually agreed. He said, okay, let's do it, and let's save up for a year, and let's see if we can do it, and saved everything I earned into this trip, this amazing trip for a 19-year-old and a 17-year-old, and off to Hawaii we went. But one of my abiding memories was that in the last week we were hit by a hurricane, so it spoiled the last week a little bit weather-wise. We were confined to our hotel, and we put the TV on, and there was this movie on, An American in Paris, and I sat and watched it, and it was a little bit familiar with old films. You know, I had been watching old films. I was quite heavily into Laurel and Hardy. I'd taken interest in Frank Sinatra films and so on. And then I just fell for this film, Hook, Line and Sinker. I thought, this is absolutely wonderful. I just got a great feeling from it, the music, the dancing. And it really set off my great interest in old movies. There's a few songs in it that I love, but I just remember watching this particular song, Gene Kelly Dancing with Children, and I just found it so warm-hearted, and I just loved it. And yeah, never looked back since, really.
I got
rhythm.
I got
music.
I got
my gal. Who could ask for anything more? Who could ask for anything more?
The mem shows up, I'll say.
I've got Rhythm by Gene Kelly there from An American in Paris, and good movie soundtracks too. Now we come to a track that marks a time for you, Gary, when you got into playing cricket and also getting into art and painting too. Had cricket always been something you had played as a young person, and who were your cricket idols when you were growing up?
Well, cricket started with my father, who was a fanatical cricketer. He played club cricket every single weekend in the summer for as long as I could remember. So I had a vested interest in going to see my dad play because it meant I could play somewhere in the park with my brother as well. He picked up cricket. And as I got older, I got into the school cricket team. And then I played club cricket, eventually playing under my dad, who was a captain, and he picked me to bowl in the team. I became an open bowler at the age of 16, as I remember, playing in the adult team. And that was red ball cricket, and I played for Stanmore Cricket Club, where I used to play with Angus Fraser, who went on to play for England. I have wonderful memories of Stanmore Cricket Club. There were some fantastic characters that played there, all storytellers that were standing in the bar, and they would hold a crowd and tell stories, and I thought, I'd love to be able to get to that point, you know. Never did, but wonderful, wonderful memories of playing cricket. And then probably around about the age of 22, I realised, you know, my sight was getting worse, and I couldn't see the ball in the field. So the ball was coming towards me, and they'll be shouting, Gary, Gary, the ball's coming. And I say, where? and it would go right past me and onto the boundary for four. I thought, well, I can't do this. I had to give it up. So I've been doing art. It was something I discovered I could do when I was in my sort of, around about 11, 12. I found I was fairly good at, and I, being an Elvis fan, it was natural to, well, let's see if I can paint Elvis. As I got a bit older, I did more and more, and I remember when I was about 16, I did this picture of Barry Manilow and in watercolour for my mum, because she was a mad Barry Manilow fan. And unbeknown to me, she did these prints. She used to work in a printer, and she went off and had these prints done up of this painting I did. And then unbeknown to me, she sent one off to the Royal Albert Hall, where Barry was performing. And then I found out that his manager had written back and said, oh, thank you for the picture, Barry liked it very much, here's 2 free tickets.
Wow.
And I thought, oh, wow. So it was a sign that, I could do this portrait art stuff. And then, as I said, I gave up cricket, and so I had my weekends free, and I just took to painting more and more. Every single weekend I was painting, and my fondest memories, this was around the mid-80s, was painting all day Sunday, listening to radio, good old Radio 2. And I got more and more into these wonderful nostalgic radio shows. And I found myself, expanding my taste in music to all the different types of music that easy listening music encompasses. And it was particularly born out in the Des Carrington show, who had a 3-hour show when I first listened to it, and he plays a real eclectic mix of music that fascinated me. And he used to have a little feature on the show called Crosby Corner. Now, I had got into Bing Crosby by this time, but I wasn't an expert on his music. I only had a few of his records. But there was one track that I remember listening to, and it really, for some reason, it always takes me back to this time. It's this combination of relaxing painting all day and listening to this music, and particularly the Des Carrington show. Really, I think this song enhanced my interest in the music of Bing Crosby, because it related to the South Pacific. It's called Trade Winds, and there's all this connection. I'm thinking, this is interesting, and I thought, I must get some more Bing Crosby records. Again, this is all building up my interest in nostalgic music that eventually led to me being able to present Sunset Melodies.
Down where the trade winds play, down where you lose.
Trade Winds there by Bing Crosby, and fond times for you painting away in your studio listening to easy listening music. We now come to a bit of a disco track for you, Gary,
yeah.
and memories of 15 years mobile disco work for you. What sort of bookings did you have when you used to run your mobile disco? And was it sort of weddings and that sort of thing, or was it other parties and stuff?
Eventually it was. I started off with the very idea of just doing 50s and 60s music. I wanted to be a specialist 50s and 60s DJ. And I managed to get a pub booking around the corner from where I lived, which I did for a year. And I used to go to this club. And what struck me was that the DJs never spoke. And I used to really like that. I thought, that's cool, you know, just play the music. You don't need to speak. So I took that up myself. I did this pub, and I just played 50s and 60s music, and I never spoke. And I always remember some guy coming up to me and said, oh, like the music, but you're a bit quiet, aren't you? And I said, yeah, well, it's just the style I've adopted. But then I an agent, chap who was starting up an agency, he got in touch with me and said, would you like to do this job? And I thought, oh, great, yeah, that'll be good. I must have paid him his commission straight away, and he was quite impressed with that. So he started to give me work, and I got so much work from him over the next sort of 4 or 5 years. But he encouraged me to expand on the kind of music I play to give me more work so I could do weddings and 18th birthday parties and things like that. So I gave in and said, okay, I'll do that. And I had to go out and buy all this modern music and stuff. But I enjoyed it because it, you know, I did like other music. I liked 70s and 80s music, and it gave me a chance to play those sort of songs that that I liked. And it was a challenge over the years because of the irony being that my sight meant I can't see very well in the dark. And of course, most of the time when you're doing disco, you are in the dark.
The track that you have chosen that marks those 15 years of your mobile disco work is December 63 by The Four Seasons. When you put on this track back then, did people get up and dance and really go for it?
Yeah, I mean, I had a difficult time trying to pick out a track. You can imagine, I played hundreds of tracks I could have played. I mean, there were two tracks that stood out. If there were two tracks that ever stood out, one was quite interesting. I remember asking the chap who ran the agency I referred to earlier, I said, what track do you think you get asked for more than any other? And he came up with the same one that I did. The one he came up with was Red Red Wine by UB40. And then the other track that everybody loved and always went down well was Dancing Queen by ABBA. So once I'd played Dancing Queen, I used to do a little set of 70s songs. They included Night Fever, I Will Survive, one or two others, but the one I usually followed Dancing Queen with was December 63 by The Four Seasons. And I loved that record when it came out, and I never ever tired of it. It was one of those songs I thought, no, it doesn't matter how many times I hear this song, I'm always going to love it. So I thought, no, I'll settle on this one, and there's my memory of those disco days.
The Four Seasons there, and A Night in December 63, and Nights for You, Gary, with your mobile disco too. We now come to a time when you decided to retire due to medical grounds and spend time looking after your kids. Was it a hard decision, making that decision to retire on medical grounds?
It wasn't. It was when you have children, your priorities change. So what happened, I was working at the office, civil service, where I'd been for 12 years by this time, and they were looking to get rid of people. Computers had just come in, and they were awful to look at, these computers. They were small, they were orange, they had an orange glow, and I thought, I can't foresee myself being able to work on these all day. There was no accessibility back then, there was no support. It was just you and the computer, and it's like, well, could I ever work with these on a long-term basis? Maybe glance at them every now and then, but not sit and work with them all day long. I just couldn't see it. At the same time, my children were very young. My son was about 2 at this time. He had been looked after by a babysitter. It didn't work out very well, and it wasn't ideal that one of us wasn't at home. My daughter came along, and so my ex-wife was at home for about 6 or 7, 8 months with her. And we took the decision that I will stay at home and look after them. But at the same time, I would start my own disco agency. So I'd work from home, look after the children, and then take medical retirement, which the civil service, where I was at, they were more than happy to give me. And it suited me because I just thought, well, at that time I could never sit there and work on computers. Not computers that we have today, of course, but back then I just couldn't do it. And so it worked out quite well.
Were they treasured times for you bringing up the kids then?
They were special times. I did appreciate the fact that I was able to spend that time with my children, because you can never get those years back. And I think that was borne out by the fact that their mother didn't spend the time. She often would say, oh, I wish I was the one looking after them, which I completely understand, and circumstances meant it was the other way around. It was challenging at times, not because of the children. I was very lucky with the children. We had wonderful kids. They were fantastic to look after. They were funny as above everything else. They just made us laugh all the time. They were wonderfully natured children. So I was very lucky. And the reason I chose this song was because it takes me back to that time when they were very young. And I always wondered whether they could ever get into the music that I listened to. And I used to play it, and I bought this Andy Williams CD, which had this track on, Up, Up and Away. And I used to like his version of it. So I remember making their dinner in the afternoon, late afternoon, after school, or whatever time it was, and they would sit there, and I would play this music, and I remember blasting it through the house for some reason. They used to join in on the song, and I thought, oh, progress, they're liking it, they're now singing along to it. I suppose it's a natural tune that children can latch on to, Up, Up and Away. They can sing those words, and the word balloon probably triggers off their imagination and things like that. So they did join in and have fun, but it's the way they did it as well. They almost did it as if it was like they were more focused on their dinner, but they were partly singing Up, Up and Away, and they might lift their heads and join in with the chorus, and then they'll just put their head back down and start eating again, And I just used to look at them doing that, and it just used to make me laugh.
Like to ride in my beautiful balloon? Would you like to glide in my beautiful balloon?
Up, Up and Away there by Andy Williams, and fond memories for you, Gary, of bringing your kids up. We now come to your final track, the one that you might like to pass on that might give people hope for the future. Gary, what is the track and why have you chosen it?
Well, this is quite a challenge, actually, to be able to convey its message. As I say, being a big Elvis fan, why haven't I chosen an Elvis track yet? Well, I left it to the end. It's not necessarily the track itself, but the words of a track that's necessarily inspiring it. It's really the whole concept of the music that I find inspiring. When I look back on Elvis's life and career, people's perception of Elvis is, oh, he's the king of rock and roll. He sang in Las Vegas and did hundreds of concerts in jumpsuits, and he made lots of films, and he was a great performer, and he was a great singer, and so on and so forth. Yes, there was all these things. But to me, the most important thing about Elvis is his whole approach to music. So if we go back, I think the most important time of his career was actually in his development as a singer. Someone who, in his teenage years when he was living in Memphis, Tennessee, how he absorbed all this music that was around at the time. And of course, Memphis was a great place because it was a mecca for music. Lots of different types of musicians would come to Memphis to perform, and he would have been exposed to all that. So it would be gospel, it would be blues, it would be country, it would be pop, jazz, everything all come to Memphis. And so he just took it all in. And I think the irony that he became the king of rock and roll was that he didn't necessarily grow up to become a rock and roll singer. He wasn't, oh, I'm going to be a rock and roll singer one day. He wasn't like that. He was just somebody who just loved music. But obviously, one of the kinds of music he loved was black rhythm and blues music. And he just loved it. Just the same as he loved listening to somebody like Eddie Arnold or Hank Williams, who were great, great country singers at the time. And he didn't necessarily prefer one over the other. There's no clues to that. He would probably have had his favourite singers, like notably Roy Hamilton as one, who was a black R&B singer, but he was also like a balladeer. I think he probably modelled himself on him more than anybody else, singing-wise. And I thought, this is really interesting. You know, when the more you learn about Elvis's young days, the more you get to understand him as a singer. He was living in Memphis, and as people may know, the famous Sun Studios are in Memphis, and he was owned by a chap called Sam Phillips. Now, he had this love of the blues, and he used to live in the Delta areas, I believe, and so he grew up listening to all this blues stuff. And when he had his recording studio, he had this great idea of bringing all these blues musicians who used to sing in the rural areas and make records. The only trouble was they didn't sell in great numbers. And he realised the problem was the prejudices of mainly white young teenagers. That was his sort of main market, I suppose. He said that because they're black, they're not going to buy the records. So he came up with the idea that the only way to really sell the music is to have a white singer sing it. And then in walks this young man called Elvis, who supposedly had perhaps what he was looking for. But when Elvis went into the studio, he probably went in thinking, well, I'll sing some ballads because I want to be a ballad singer. That's how I see myself. But he just happened to like all this other music, and he tried a few ballads, and Sam Phillips was thinking, oh, it's not really what I'm looking for, but carry on, you know. And as the legend goes, they had a break during these recording tryouts, and Elvis picked up his guitar and started messing around on this song called That's All Right, Mama. And Sam Phillips said, that's it, that's what I'm looking for. Now, That's All Right, Mama is an old blues tune. But what was important about Elvis singing this was the fact that he sang it as if he was a blues singer, as if he was a rhythm and blues singer. He had that voice, that beat in his voice, that rhythm in his voice. It just came to him. It was just very natural. It was no big deal to him. He just sang it. He just loved it, so he sang it. He broke down that door of making people realise that we can all get on board and do it all.
Well, thank you so much, Gary Moritz, for sharing your Tracks of My Life with me here on RNIB Connect Radio.
Well, thank you very much, Toby. It's been an absolute pleasure.